Chapter 9. Staffing Issues. Jinzan fidgeted in his seat, an endeavor he was little familiar with. He was seated at the hexagonal stone table of the Magrin High Council, listening as each of his fellow counselors gave their report on the state of their preparations on the eve of the invasion of Kadrin. He was not looking forward to the prospect of his own. While there was no petitioner to the council, leaving the sixth side of the table vacant, the five high counselors were far from alone. Desks and tables ringed the walls of the room, where assorted functionaries listened and recorded. Even casual comments made in the council chamber were recorded for posterity, and more than a few in the room had little purpose there but to write the land's history as it occurred. Others there ensured that orders were carried out with all practical haste. Troop deployments could be relayed by lieutenants who waited near the chamber's doors. Requests for information were often returned by the end of longer meetings. Rumors could be spread throughout the city before the counselors adjourned for the midday meal, whether they intended such rumors to be spread or not. Council meetings were thus half rulership, half theater. Had Jinzan been alone among his old friends, he could have borne their censure quietly and deservedly. It was an embarrassment lying in wait for him, though, with the crowded council chamber. His only hope to avert public loss of face was that the situation resolved itself before it was his turn to present the readiness of the kingdom's sorcerers for the war. The blockade will be in place by the morrow. Any ships that wish to reach Kadrus are going to have to venture a long way out of their course to bypass our ships, Varduk Steelraven reported. 20 years earlier, he had become de facto admiral of the rebellion's navy. When none of the Magrin back then knew anything of ships but fishing and trade, Varduk had pieced together a functioning navy out of trade ships and second-hand cast-offs from other kingdoms' fleets. Ever since, he had overseen both Magrin sea trading and their navy, though he left the actual sailing to much younger men. It will not do much, but it is prudent, I suppose. We will need the blockade much closer to Kadrus before they feel any real pain from it, said General Kanan Baltaga, the Magrin Minister of War. Once the face of the rebellion, she had been a ferocious beauty who commanded the Striped Cat Cavalry that had done so much to help free Magrin. Reckless and wild, she inspired both the men and the women of the rebellion, and most of the men were willing to die for one chance to bed her. Her close-cropped hair was white now, still teased with ointments into a forest of short spikes like she had worn in her youth, and it stood out starkly against her deep brown skin. Her once muscular body had grown thick and soft, covered in a layer of flab that she attributed to the posterity that had come following the rebellion. The breasts that had once numbed the reason of her troops had grown huge and sagging, having nursed 6 children of her own and 12 fosterling orphans in the early years after the war. She adorned herself in gold and silks instead of armor, but her spirit was as fierce as the day she first charged headlong into the Kadrin garrison as they drilled in the practice yard. The first strike of the war. If any were to embody the rebellion in the hearts of Magrin, it was Kanan Bloodstorm Baltaga. In time, the war will not be quick. We must have a long view of it, Varduk replied. We start with the periphery, just as you plan for the land war. Ultimately, we will have to lay siege to Kadrus, but that day is a long way off. Their strength is concentrated there, and we will not dislodge it by direct action. We must whittle away at their borders and draw their strength out to us. They have more troops than us, more sorcerers too, but they have far more land to defend with them. We just need to track their movements and wait for the opportune time to pick them apart.
Speaking of troop deployments,
Narse, how are the Kadrin forces looking? General Kanan asked.
They are scrambling to prepare for our attack. It looks as if they are prepared to concede border territory,
Narsekan Tenrock answered. The only other sorcerer besides Jinzan to sit among the High Council, Narsekan oversaw Magrin's web of spies and informants. Less gifted in open warfare than was Jinzan, Narsekan concentrated more on defending Magrin from magic
than inflicting his own on others. While Jinzan had been trained among the Kadrans after they decided, foolishly, that Magrin was integrated sufficiently into the Empire,
Narsican kept his magic secret from the occupiers
his whole life. They have already evacuated many of the less defended towns, leaving token forces that I expect will flee as we approach. I think we shall find the resistance much heavier once we get farther inside their borders. Moon, Garsley, Pevitt, Reaver's Crossing, all seem to be receiving reinforcements.
What news from Cadris? Asked Ferron Darjak, Magrin's interior minister and the only member of the High Council who was not one of the liberators.
He had taken over for the great General Ashton Sweely, who had been an old man when the rebellion started, and who had served Magrin well into early senility before retiring to spend his last few years at leisure with his great-grandchildren. Ferron had fought in the rebellion as well, but he had earned his position largely based on his valuable service under Sweely in the Interior Ministry.
Not much of import. We have lost 3 sneaks and 4 informants trying to gain access to substantive information on their military plans. That demon is too quick to kill anything that smells wrong to him. I would bet good coin he kills 3 by mistake for every 1 of ours he gets, Narsican said. We know that they are having a major wedding planned for the 1st of spring. The demon's avowed son and some Archon heiress. As always, pomp and self-congratulation come before practical matters. Jinzan could not help chiming in. He had intended to keep quiet until his turn to report on the state of the sorcerers and his cannons.
Why can I not just let such matters lie? Stupid, stupid.
To our advantage, Barduk observed, drawing nods from Narsican and Kanan. For that day at least, we ought to know the whereabouts of the demon and many of the inner circle, Ferron observed. Would that not be the best day to make our first real strike?
The frosts have not broken yet over much of Kadrin. Their lingering winter is saving them from our stripe cats for another 10 days. I have mono horns ready to assault Timble Hill on the 1st of springtime, which is tomorrow, I must remind you, Ferron, Kanan said curtly. She never respected Ferron's position on the council, though she knew it was inevitable that the liberators would someday need successors. She just did not like the fact and resented him meddling in her planning.
Perhaps Jinzan can duplicate his little transference trick and take some remote city himself. With the demon preoccupied, it seems almost a shame to let the opportunity pass. After all, what better use to test out the staff of Galen? Ferron suggested.
Are you mad? Narsican broke in.
Good. He can save me from having to say much the same and sound like a coward,
Jinzan thought. After all that Jinzan went through to secure it, Narsican said, it is the key to our defenses against Kadrin sorcerers. Wherever the wielder of that staff is, we will have an advantage against any opponent. We cannot risk losing it with something so chancy as a transference spell.
Not what I had in mind, Narsi. Your concern for my safety is touching as well.
All right, Ferron said. No need to flay me in the council chambers over it. Consider my suggestion withdrawn. Anyway, it is about time we heard from Jinzan about the sorcerer's readiness. Is everything in order for the invasion to begin? Ferron inquired, giving Jinzan a simpering smile in the hope that he had given him something to brag about and ease the tension he had caused.
Well, Jinzan paused and drew a deep breath. Not quite.
Elsewhere in Zoran, small hands fumbled with the latch of a stable door. One hand simply was not enough, at least not for a boy of 10 springtimes. Anzik tucked the staff of Galen awkwardly under one arm and used both hands to spring the door open. It was a task that could easily have been accomplished with magic, but Anzik had not thought of that. His first instinct was to open the door using his hands, and that thought stayed lodged in his mind until he was finished with it.
They will look for me. I took Father's staff. My staff now, They will look for me. Hide. Need to hide.
It was hard to concentrate. Anzac had to keep reminding himself where he was, what he was doing. The voices were badgering him again. He knew that if he concentrated on the task at hand, he could wait them out and they would stop for a while. The door creaked only a little as Anzac pushed his way through, not daring to open it wide and draw attention.
Be quiet. Horses make noise. Quieter than a horse and they will not hear me. If they do not hear me, they cannot find me. Quieter than a horse. Quieter than a horse.
Anzac settled himself in an empty stall in the back, paying scant attention to the horses that occupied the half-full stable. He could see in the ether, looking through the walls, that the stable boy was just outside. It was an enclosed stable, well vented but with full walls on all sides. It seemed like a good place to hide. Anzac had been hiding for days, moving from one place to another. He knew that he had stolen his father's staff. He knew that meant he would get in trouble when he was found.
I just need to hide long enough to grow up. Everyone says I will be more powerful than father when I grow up.
Stop it! I am not hungry! Anzac clutched his ears, trying to block out the voices. But it was in vain. I just ate. I took pies from the market. He could not reason with the voices. The voices told him to eat. They told him to open his mouth, to try just a little. Sometimes the voices blathered on about nonsense, which was easy to block out. When they got insistent, sometimes he had to just give in to make them go away. Anzac opened his mouth, keeping his eyes clamped shut and hands pressed over his ears. He felt something warm and mushy in his mouth, and then felt a spoon. He closed his mouth and felt the spoon pull out. The mush was not unpleasant, tasting of potato and carrot, and Anzac swallowed it. He opened his mouth again and another spoonful followed the first. He knew from having lost the battle with the voices that once was never enough. When it finally stopped, the voices went quiet. Anzac opened his eyes and fell back into a pile of hay. His mind was quiet. He was sweating, breathing quickly, but he felt free. After a few moments to compose himself, he took stock of his surroundings with a clearer head. He had wandered into one of the wealthier parts of Zorin, where someone had money and land enough to have their own stable within the city. Zorin sprawled with bustling markets filled with people and warehouses stacked with trade goods, intermixed with tiny orchards, walled estates, and public parks. There were hardly any people about where Anzac had stashed himself. There was a stable boy, a groom, and a half dozen horses, though those probably did not count as people. Anzac was exhausted. His newfound freedom had made him bold, and he had fought against the voices longer than usual, but had not prevailed. Most often he would block them out, losing himself in whatever task he could find, then placate them quickly when they became too intrusive.
I bested father. I will best the voices too. Maybe tomorrow.
Anzac wanted to sleep. It was only midday, but both his mind and body felt used up. Running away was hard work.
I should disguise myself, in case they look in here where I sleep. I cannot let them see me here. Something innocuous. Maybe just make the hay pile look a bit larger than it had been.
It was easier to think when the only thoughts in his head were his own. Even at home, it seemed rare to have a truly quiet moment, with so many other people around. Anzac needed no gestures or words for his magic. He had been seeing how his father and the other sorcerers did it since he was a babe. He could get the ether to respond much more easily than they. Mimicking what the ether did when they commanded it was, for Anzac, child's play. He began to draw in a bit of ether, for a simple illusion. Few in Magrin were well versed in the art, but after Anzac had seen it, it had become one of his favorites to practice, causing no end of strife in the Fair household. He wanted to ensure that the spell would last the length of his nap at least, so he drew in a bit more ether than he normally would have for a simple prank. the staff of Galen threw things amiss. Still barely having tested the artifact's power, Anzik unintentionally called on the staff's draw to augment his own. Amplified many times over, the ether was sucked toward the staff like a funnel of a cyclone. Anzik's persistent ether vision saw a vortex forming around him as his draw sped beyond his control. Horses whinnied in terror, feeling their very life forces being wrenched at, and the nearest one to Anzik's stall fell over dead before he could stop drawing in ether. Anzik felt the roiling power thrashing about within his source. It was the most he had ever held at once, but it was not foremost on his mind.
I broke the horse. I scared the horses. The horses made noise. They must have heard. They will come to look. They will find me. I need to hide. No, I need to fix the horse. How? Is it really dead? I pulled out its ether. Maybe I can just put it back.
Anzik's vision had been keen enough that he could make out the hollowed remains of the horse's source. Carefully, he directed much of the ether back where it had come from, filling the source like a vintner filled bottles. The source did not look quite healthy when he finished, but the horse obeyed his silent command to get to its feet. Somehow the other horses could sense something wrong with their comrade. The one in the stall, bearing a placard that identified it as Snowflake, began to panic and try to break free of her confinement.
No, stop that! They will come look!
Anzik panicked. It was no good fixing one horse if the rest were going to give him away. He looked around at the contagious fear among the residents of the stable, then back to the horse he had just fixed. Thinking quickly, he pointed the staff at the panicked horse and deliberately drew its source dry of ether. The creature fell limply to the ground, its muscles flaccid and unresisting. That set off a general panic among the rest of the horses, beasts intelligent enough to realize there was something horrifically wrong. Anzik silenced the rest of them as well, and his head swam as the vast wave of ether crashed down over his senses. He stumbled to the nearest empty sourced horse and refilled it, easing the pain of too much stored ether. Each horse he had fixed made him feel a bit better, both in eased pain and eased worry. With the ruckus he had caused, it was too much for Anzik to have hoped that he had not drawn attention. Behind him, he saw a small human source approaching the stable, the stable boy.
"Hey now, what's wrong in here?"
the lad called out as he approached.
"Skunk got inside with you or something?"
The horses were all quiet and gathering themselves up on their feet again, but the boy had heard too much already. Anzik's eyes turned toward the stable door, waiting for the boy's image in the ether to merge with the light, to see him as a person rather than just a source. He was a boy about Anzik's own age, perhaps a summer or two older, but bigger and with the healthy look of a lad raised in fresh air.
"Hey, what are you doing in here, scaring my horses?" the boy demanded.
"I'm sorry. I will go. Please do not tell anyone I was here."
Anzik meant to say it aloud, but the words only echoed in his own head. His tongue felt like a sack of flour in his mouth, limp and heavy.
"I asked you a question, kid. What are you doing in here with my horses?"
the stable boy persisted, approaching threateningly. Anzik held the staff of Galen clutched close to his body, but it did not seem like much of a weapon in Anzik's hands, scrawny as he was.
"Nothing. I did not kill them. They are fine, see?"
Anzik's eyes widened as the stable boy was not accepting either his apology or his excuses. He took a step backward.
"Please, leave me alone. Please?"
"Fine then. Looks like I get to pound ya."
They were the stable boy's last words. When Anzik fled the stable, he left his would-be assailant standing mutely, staring at one of the horses, slowly leaking unhealthy ether.
"Curse you, Jinzan,"
Narsikan scolded, a rarity in open council.
"You should have told us as soon as it went missing."
"I had hoped that I would be able to retrieve it discreetly before it became an issue requiring the council's attention," Jinzan responded defensively. How long has the boy been gone? Kanan asked, sounding concerned. I cannot imagine Anzik on his own in Zorin.
Nor could I until now. I'm finding myself impressed with his resourcefulness, despite the inconvenience he is causing, Jinzan admitted.
Anzik had always been possessed of more promise than usefulness.
He has a source that burns like a little bonfire, and a draw many adult sorcerers would envy. He casts nearly all his spells in his head, and sees ether as clear as daylight. If the latter had not driven him to the edge of madness as a young child, he might have become a warlock one day.
Jinzan still held out hope for his son, despite all practical evidence that he was a lost cause. But it was not his job as a father to give up on Anzik.
What if someone has already taken him? Narsikan asked. Did you think of that when you decided not to enlist help looking for him?
No, but I remembered his pet dog. There were uncomfortable looks shared about the table. They all knew that the boy had dabbled in necromancy recently. I preferred to send folk he knew and would recognize. He is young and naive, more so than even most boys his age. He might be taken by treachery, but I would like to think that if there had been brute force involved, we would have felt the ether rock under the force of him using the staff to defend himself.
Not all of us notice such things, Jinzan, Varduk commented somberly, trying to defuse a potential argument to get the conversation back on course.
If he truly tried to use it to its fullest extent, you might, Jinzan said. He had felt the awesome power when he had transferred himself halfway across Coria after the Battle of Rainsdark, using the staff's draw to give him the ether he needed.
If they have been turned to undead puppets, so be it. That staff needs finding. We will be cautious and they will bring no harm to the boy. But we cannot let it wander loose in the city, Narsikan ordered, looking over his shoulder to see that one of his assistants nod to him in understanding and hasten off to carry out his command.
Now that we have something being done about that missing staff, I thought of another question for you, Narsikan.
Farron piped up cheerily,
trying to lighten the dour, contentious mood that was threatening to cast a pall over the remainder of the meeting.
Yes?
You mentioned that you had lost men in Cadrus. Does that mean we have none now? Or are there still assets we can avail ourselves of?
Farron asked.
I have this idea, you see. The ones left are untethered, Narsikan interrupted. They have general orders, but do not report back on any schedule, and are left to their own resources. It is safer for them if they do not have our people trying to contact them.
As such, I have no count of exactly how many are left.
Or where they are now, but they are men and women I trust completely, and whose loyalty I do not question. Save your suggestion for when we have new recruits to send in. I will not try contacting any of our current spies in Cadrus.
Oh, up to anything mischievous? Farron grinned.
Jinzan was spared the council's scorn as it turned to Farron and his insipid questions. Since word could not reach Cadrus in time, I suppose there is no harm in revealing that there is a plan in place to coincide with the first day of springtime, Narsikan relented, trying to placate the simpering fool of an interior minister. Farron was brilliant in his own work, but he was so bothersome at council. Everyone just wanted him to shut up so they could finish.
Something for a wedding, perhaps? Farron pressed.
With no further business requiring attention, a quick glance among the other four members ended the High Council's session by mutual agreement, leaving Farron's question unanswered as they got up simultaneously and left. A few chuckles from the outskirts of the room followed their departure, many from Farron's own underlings.
How long will it take us to get there?
Though he looked like a traitor from Gardenel, he spoke with Faelin Sarmon's voice.
He sat up front in the wagon next to the driver.
A team of four horses, fine, strong animals native to Western Magrin, pulled them along.
3 days at this rate, replied a man who sounded, but did not look like Aelin Beth.
Phelan's magic was making them appear as foreigners, so that they did not attract undue attention as they trekked northward to Magrin territory. The wagon, the horses, and the clothes they wore were taken from actual Gardenel traders that had the misfortune of being in Cadran at the time Aelin had been assigned by the warlock to find them a cover story. The goods they carried in trade were plundered from the Song of Night, which Phelan's magic had fooled into plowing into a sandbar. So many people on the road. You would never think that we were on the very threshold of war, Phelan commented. Cadran's citizens streamed southward, seeking safety in the heartlands. Magrin and other foreigners ambled alongside Phelan and his companions on their way north, to anywhere but Cadran, the continent's most popular place for anyone not of Cadran blood.
"Dunno about that," Jodul's voice came from the back of the wagon,
where he and Todd diced as best they could on the bumpy road.
"Folk know what's good for 'em. War, ain't it?" "Yeah, it's like them hunting dogs what can smell fear, except in reverse," Todd observed sagely.
Phelan furrowed the brow of his borrowed face, unable to follow the analogy as it was spoken, but understanding what Todd probably meant.
"So once we got that staff, then what?" Jodul asked.
"I do not expect to have that question troubling us for some time yet," Phelan replied. "Like as not, it is either under lock and ward, or in the hands of that sorcerer who stole it in the first place. The opportunity to gain it may take some time in the arranging."
"Oh, we might just all die trying," Aelin suggested, keeping an open mind about their options.
"In the meantime, we will worm our way into their confidences however we can manage. If we cannot make a play for the staff immediately, we can find other ways to disrupt them and divert them," Phelan continued.
"I travel with three who barely speak Magrin, and speak it with a Cadran accent, not a Gardenel one," Phelan thought. "I must remember that they are the expendable ones here, my cover. I must retrieve the staff and bring it safely back to Warlock Roshan. Barring that, I must see it destroyed. I will save their lives if I might, but I must not risk my mission by it."
Phelan looked to Aelin and the two rough scamps that gambled in the back of the wagon. He did not dislike them or anything,